So Amy, tell me about a hard thing that you've walked through that you learned a lot from.
One of the things that came to mind was the move that we had. So we've been here, gosh, almost 20 years now. But when we moved from Barry's hometown to Wake County near Raleigh, that was a really hard time for me because my friendships did not follow me here, if that makes sense. So I had a lot of friends that really didn't keep in touch. And I felt very out of sight, out of mind. Now, whether that was true, I don't know, but they didn't keep in touch. And it was so, so painful. Mm-hmm. But I was in my late 30s. And so it was a time that I had to start really looking at friendships, what I valued, what I invested. It was a time that I learned so much and sort of redefined what I was going to base my friendships on. And so it was a great learning time, but it was really painful. Have you had a time like that?
Oh, which one should I choose? You know, the one that comes to mind probably the most right now is my first decade plus of teaching. I just could not seem to get things. I couldn't get it right. Like, I love my students. I went to all the seminars. I was constantly working. But there's three main things a teacher has to do. Has to plan the lessons, has to show up in the classroom and teach, and then stay on top of grading. And I could never figure out how to do all three. Like, I could get two of them out of the three, but I just never seemed to be able to balance all three reasonably well. And I was just constantly exhausted. Like, always, always feeling like a failure. And the thing that was hard back then, especially I wasn't even a recovering perfectionist, is I believed if I just tried harder, I would finally be able to catch up and finally achieve the sense of being a professional. When I learned about 8 years ago now, the concept of being a highly sensitive person, and that I am an HSP, it helped me understand why teaching all day long was so depleting. Oh, and that it was too much. And I had been trying to force myself to do something that was actually tearing me down in the process. The lesson out of all of that was, oh, it's not me. I'm not a failure. It's not that I'm not trying hard enough. And I cut back to part-time teaching. And now, of course, I only teach one class a day. I'm now able to stay on top of the planning and the teaching and the grading. And it really feels like a sweet spot. And so the pain from those years of feeling like a failure has actually been able to inform wiser decisions that have led me to a much better place for where I am right now.
Aren't we thankful that painful places are learning places and that they're not unredeemable, that they are redeemed by the learning and the wisdom that we get from them?
Well, this is Sherry Gregory.
And I'm Amy Carroll.
And you're listening to Grit and Grace, the podcast that equips you to lose who you're not, love who you are, and live your one life well.
Today, we're talking to Meg Apperson, author of Sky Full of Stars, Learning to Surrender to God's Perfect Plans. Meg is a blogger, homeschooling mother, and a pastor's kid. She's married to Cody. Together, they live in North Carolina with their four children. Meg is a passionate lover of words, advocate for medically fragile children, and aspiring minimalist.
Meg Apperson grew up having a relationship with Jesus, and she always trusted God. But it wasn't until her daughter Avery, a miracle in so many ways, was born with a litany of life-threatening birth defects that she began to fully understand what it means to trust Jesus with everything.
In this heartbreakingly beautiful memoir, you'll learn how a mother fought for her child, her family, and even herself as she grappled with the weight of failure, of letting down everyone around her and feeling let down by God.
But in the midst of the fight, through heavy grief, she not only discovered her own voice, she discovered that God is both good and faithful.
If you have ever experienced grief, suffering, or pain,
if God has ever asked you to surrender more than you thought possible,
if you've ever questioned how God is at work in the darkness,
Sky Full of Stars is for you. This book will show you that when everything around you is dark, peace can be found in the suffering. You'll discover new ways to rely on God's trustworthiness.
Meg, we're so glad that you're here with us today. Tell us the backstory of Sky Full of Stars. What led you to write this book?
I had always loved to write as a little kid. So writing was something that I was drawn to when I was processing things. The reason I wrote the book was because I felt like the story was just too magnificent to keep to myself. You know, I had blogged about Avery's life since she was born, and I did that mainly to keep people up to date. You know, it's a very efficient way to provide people with a lot of really complicated information. So I did that initially just to like let our friends and family know what was going on. And then people started showing up to the blog, people I didn't know, you know, and the readership grew so quickly. It was like, I can't believe people I don't know are caring about this, are loving us and loving Avery and wanting to know more. And the messages were always the same, you know, like my journey is not the same, my story is not the same, but, you know, reading about really the miraculous life of Avery and how God was so faithful to us through that time was touching people. And so I realized, you know, a lot of times I wanted to hide and not tell the story. It's scary to be so vulnerable. But seeing God use it over and over was what, you know, really pushed me to say in the times where I didn't feel confident that I, you know, didn't have a voice, that somebody else could tell this better. It was like, just be faithful and he can use the story however he wants to use it.
So good.
I read the what I think may have been your first blog post. It was after an ultrasound that was of concern. So can you just share with our listeners just a little bit about Avery's story? I know something that big, condensing it down to a nutshell is hard, but can you just kind of give us the short version here?
So when I was about 7 months pregnant, I went in for an extra ultrasound. We were looking for a different complication, nothing with Avery. And during the ultrasound, I noted that there was something unusual about her skull. The tech did not note this, but I just had this gut feeling that something is really wrong here. So after the ultrasound, my midwife read it and the radiologist had not read anything of concern. They weren't looking for a problem with the baby. So they just were not totally focused on that. Mm-hmm. So with a little advocating, a little being pushy, I was able to see a specialist and they told us that there was indeed a problem with Avery's skull, that at least two of her skull sutures had fused prematurely. And that kind of ushers in a cascade of other structural issues, because when those skull plates close, everything else around it is affected. So, mm-hmm. You know, eyes, ears, nose, a lot of things. Avery has a syndrome, so it's a craniofacial syndrome. So it does impact other parts of her anatomy, but where you really see it is brain, eyes, nose, ears, airway. So she was born. We did not know how severe the syndrome would be. It ended up being very devastating, very impactful for her. She needed a trach, a G-tube, a shunt, a ventilator for a time. So it's a lot. That's how we found it.
How old is Avery now?
Avery's five.
Avery's five. Okay. So this has been basically a 6-year journey for you at this point.
Yes.
So from your experiences here, how can we as Christians best love and support those who are going through seasons of suffering, especially those that are connected to physical and mental health?
Yeah. So I would say practical things are really helpful, you know, especially when it's involving mental health or physical things that are going on. There's a lot of physical limitation to that. You know, you're at doctor's appointments or you've been up all night with a baby who's recovering from surgery. And so practical things like bringing a meal or sending a gift card for coffee or anything that eases a burden of, you know, making a meal, anything that eases a financial burden, because there are those, you know. I think anybody who's going through a physical crisis, you're kind of just bleeding resources everywhere, even if you have great insurance. And so I would say just chipping in a practical way or offering to watch other older children or take them out to do something fun, because it's, you know, really hard on other children when you have a child who has some some physical limitations. And then I would say that a little research goes a long way. In, you know, you go to church and 10 different people will ask you, so how is Avery doing? Mm. And to explain in depth every time so that they understand it is very time consuming. So when somebody is sending out, you know, text or email or writing a blog post, giving you information, to just do a little due diligence to kind of know just the surface level of what they're talking about is really helpful so that you can know how to pray, know how to support, and show them that you're invested by looking into what they're talking about, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. So in your case, what might be a better question or a question that's a little easier than hearing how's Avery doing 10 separate times? Is there a slightly different phrasing that would actually be easier for you to receive?
Not a question, I guess. Mm-hmm. The, you know, a sentence of, I read your latest post, mm-hmm. or I talked to your mom and she said this and I'm praying for her. You know, something that's that doesn't put the responsibility on the person to have to answer, if that makes sense.
Oh. 100%.
That is such great advice. And I don't know that I've ever heard it said that way before. Mm. Wonderful. Wonderful. So you've done such a good job at this, Meg, but how can the rest of us use our stories of hardship to speak hope and life into others?
Just putting that into practice, honestly, you know, that could mean telling your story, however that happens naturally for you. Maybe that's just in one-on-one relationship, maybe that's in a mentorship role, maybe that's blogging, maybe that's not blogging, maybe that's just sharing on Facebook. I think there's an element of advocacy that always finds its way into a trial. You know, when you face something you haven't before and you become passionate about supporting your child or your husband or yourself or whoever it is that you're supporting, I think you kind of naturally want to share that. You want to help other people who are coming behind you or who are just watching. So I think just finding your medium, whatever that is, it can look different for everybody. And then practicing that maybe privately at first, writing, you know, in a journal or having a conversation with your family first before you take it, you know, to other people. I think just knowing that whatever the story is, it's important. Whatever your perspective is, it's important. If God's given it to you, He meant for you to share it.
I love that idea of advocacy in the midst of it. And I would think it would give you a sense of power over your own story too, rather than it happening to you, that you are sharing a narrative, and that's powerful.
What would you say to people who think that suffering, pain, and trials are punishments from God? And did you ever feel like your pain was a punishment? So you can feel free to answer that in either order.
Right. So I think this is just part of the grace of God, that when we make poor choices, consequences are a great teacher. So I know there are times where we can be in suffering and in a trial that's of our own making, and the Lord lets us experience consequences to teach us as discipline. And so I think there's that, where it's not punishment. I think it's a loving allowance on His part. As far as trial that you don't bring on yourself, I do not think it's punishment. I think it's always preparation. I don't think it's ever wasted. I don't think that you're in this trial just for yourself. I know there is a refining aspect for you. And then I know it's about building a story of God's faithfulness, honestly, every time. So I don't see trials as punishment. I don't see suffering as punishment. I think it's a very necessary way of earning our stripes, in a way, earning the story, you know, the legacy that we are writing by living the way we do.
So what's the most important lesson, Meg, that you've learned from the pain that you endured?
I don't think I could boil it down to one most important thing. I would say that things that I've learned that I really cherish, that make me so grateful that this is been my journey, is that I think that suffering is so loving. I know that sounds crazy. It's so loving of God to allow us to be refined in a way that really condenses our faith, condenses our story, that really shows us our passions and our priorities, and really reveals when everything kind of gets boiled down, when you're left with what's truly important in suffering. It's a place that you really can't get to any other way. There's no mountaintop that can reveal to you your strengths at such a fundamental level. And I think that, maybe this is my favorite thing. I think that there is a way of knowing Jesus in the valley that you cannot find any other place. You know, I think Jesus does his most intricate change and loving on us in times where he's really all we have, when what's left is me and Jesus, and you could take everything else away, but that unity, that knowing him better in deep, deep suffering is really, really precious to me.
We asked you to share a focal scripture for our time together. Why did you choose Isaiah 48:10? And I'll just, for our readers who may not have it by memory, I'll just go ahead and share it. It says, "See, I have refined you, though not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction."
I love that it acknowledges God's purposeful hand in our suffering. That, you know, when you're in a place of suffering, it could feel like God's abandoned you, or something happened where he doesn't know this was going to happen, or he's surprised by your, you know, by your trial. And it's kind of just a reminder that he's not surprised. He's there. He can use it. You know, he works all things for the good of those who love him. It's just that reinforcement of there's purpose here. Hold on to the purpose, even when it's just so painful that you're not sure you could keep going.
Well, we always invite our listeners to give us some questions. And this topic of suffering is obviously just one that resonates so much. And they came up with some great questions for us, Meg. So here's the first one. How can we hold and honor our own suffering and the suffering of others in such a way that we don't greet that suffering with dismissive platitudes or easy solutions? I'm sure you have people, you know, so often we just don't know what to say. And I'm sure you have people that just offered those platitudes. What'd you do with that? And how did you handle that?
Yeah. So comparative suffering is a very slippery slope. And it's so hard because it's so natural to us. Like, we want to relate to someone in pain. We want to have an answer for them. And so a lot of times it's like by sharing our story, and it can seem like we're one-upping, but we're really just trying to say, I understand, I relate, I've been there, or I've been somewhere similar. And so I think it's natural. I think a lot of people don't even realize that we're engaging in comparative suffering. And so for me, it was meeting that kind of thing with grace, recognizing that when someone is saying something that is probably insensitive, that they're just trying to relate to me in the best way they know how. So by just saying, yes, I see your pain too, and thank you for sharing that with me. And just having this generosity of soul to say, I know that you're trying to love me here, so I'm gonna see this as love, even if I recognize that maybe it's not the smartest thing to say. And I know I've done it too. I know that I've not known how to offer support, offer verbal support. We all do it. So I think kind of coming up with what we say to people that is not dismissive, that just says, I see you and I'm here for you and I want to listen, and here's a gift card to get coffee if you ever get a minute away, or can I come watch your kids for a couple of hours so you can go to a coffee shop by yourself? Just not ever bringing our suffering or other people's suffering in, just saying, I see yours because it's important, because you're important.
That is such a mature response, Meg. I mean, I don't mean to, but I'm like, I think in your shoes, I would have had a harder time to come up with that much grace. So thank you for that.
Meg, can you unpack that term comparative grief? Because I saw Amy's eyes go wide on that, and I've not heard that term before. So could you just tell us a little bit more about that? Because that's really important.
Very powerful.
Yeah. So comparative suffering is kind of like on the spectrum of suffering, we want a score. So, you know, my suffering is at an 80 and somebody shares something that I think is at a 30. And so I want to say, well, you don't understand because we're 50 points apart, you know, so mine is worse. And so people will say, you know, somebody will have lost their child to cancer. And so another person will say, yes, I understand. I had an early miscarriage one time. And so to both of those people, that is 100% suffering. And those are real loss that you can't compare because they're apples and oranges. And so the person who lost their child to cancer, that can feel like, well, you are negating all the 7 or 8 years that I had with my child and saying that it's an equal suffering. And it is an equal suffering because suffering is individual to us. You know, suffering is perceived, grief is perceived. So it is just as painful. But it's kind of hard for us on that scale of, you know, what, you know, it, with the pandemic, some people have lost family members and other people have lost jobs. And to both of those people, mm-hmm. that is your real, real suffering. And so to say, you shouldn't say that you're suffering because you lost your job when other people have lost their family members really robs us of the necessary part of grieving and accepting and the healing that comes from saying, this was really hard for me. I am suffering and I need to feel that suffering and accept it and then kind of move out of it when I can. The other thing is that people put a timeline on grief depending on what you've lost. So they'll say, you know, for a miscarriage, perhaps, you know, you should be able to get over it. You can have other children. You can, you know, anything like that. That is so dismissive and so painful to people who have struggled with infertility. And, you know, whatever the suffering is, whatever the loss is, it's up to each person to grieve how they want, to grieve in the timeline, to feel as destroyed and lost and to feel as much pain as they have to in that. And just because maybe we think we've suffered more or our suffering should be able to go on longer, it's just another person's grief journey is not a reflection of us. Our grief journey is not a reflection of other people. We all have, you know, suffering and grieving autonomy in that way. So that's how I would define comparative suffering.
I literally never heard the term comparative suffering. And that just, thank you so much. That's a huge takeaway. We will be talking about that in our conversation.
Yes, we will. And autonomous grieving. That's another, yes. I'm like, okay. Mm. Yes.
We are definition girls. So you are speaking our language here.
I am too.
All right. So here's another question from one of our listeners. She said, so I know it's not healthy to keep things bottled up, but how do I talk about something or get help without being a burden or a whiner?
So I would say those definitions start with us. We feel like we're burdens. We feel like we're whiners. And so just taking those off the table to say, however you need to process is how you need to process. So saying, I'm not a burden. I'm not a whiner, even if I'm having to process things verbally or everything like that. So for me, I see a therapist. I started to see one shortly after Avery was born and just have kept that going over the years. You know, sometimes I'll take a year break or so, or a 6 months break, 6 month break, and then kind of come back. And I think that's so important to have a space where, you know, you're not a burden, you know, you're not a whiner. This is what those people are for. And it also takes kind of the pressure off other family members, say a spouse who, it's hard to be your spouse's sounding board sometimes when you're grieving things like, you know, the loss of a dream regarding a child or something like that. Giving that gift to the people around you to see a professional who really can guide you in a way that they're trained to do is I think really vital. And then I would say, if you don't have access to a therapist, if you have a pastor whose job it is to help counsel people, and then maybe start with journaling. You know, something that can get your thoughts on paper, let you see, you know, when you put it down in word form, you know, letting that be a mirror to reflect back to you. What is it that I'm really feeling? What is it that I'm really needing? And kind of doing that work yourself before you take it to other people, instead of just kind of vomiting all the processing on other people. And it's hard. I'm a verbal processor. I know other people are. And so for us, we kind of need to have that feedback from another person, another face, another set of eyes to hear us process. But especially when we know we're external processors, to put it in word form first and kind of condense what maybe we're seeing or feeling or whatever it is, and kind of do the due diligence for yourself first you know, as an act of this is self-care.
So practical. So practical.
Yeah, you've given us lots of just good practical advice in this interview, Meg. Thank you for that. So if you could go back to your 20-year-old self, Meg, what would you tell her knowing what you know now?
I would say God never wastes pain, and self-betrayal is not loving. Being honest and vulnerable and, man, honest, that's a big one. And finding your identity in Jesus is going to be really important.
Could you unpack that term self-betrayal real quick?
Yeah. I'm glad you asked, Sherry, because I thought that sounds impactful.
Oh, yes. So self-betrayal are the things that we do that hurt us. We do them for other people to keep them happy, to have them approve of us, to keep the waters calm. And sometimes I kept my mouth shut a lot in order to avoid upsetting people, in order to avoid seeming loud or aggressive. And it was dangerous for me as a young person. And it was dangerous for Avery when times came that I had to advocate. And that meant being a little pushy. That meant making people angry. That meant throwing my weight around a little bit. And I realized that being quiet or going without for the sake of other people, and not in a unselfish way, in a way that allowed people to engage in unsafe behaviors or dishonest behavior, was self-betrayal that helped no one. And I thought that being quiet, I thought that going with the flow was unselfish. It was loving people, but it wasn't when what I needed to do was open my mouth and say, this is wrong, or this needs to be done, or God told me this, and letting the chips fall where they may.
Whew. You've given us a lot to talk about in our follow-up conversation. That is awesome. Those are, we're word girls too. So we just love these terms. There's, you know, several of these that you've thrown out are rich. So what closing words do you have to motivate our listeners who want to find goodness in suffering?
So I think to find goodness in suffering, you first have to acknowledge your suffering. I think especially as Christians, and I know this is the case for me, early on in Avery's journey, I felt like I always needed to find the silver lining, and that I had to just stay in finding the goodness, finding the purpose, and those are all important things. And really, I think the main point of suffering, but at the same time, I had to stop looking for the silver lining sometimes and just let the suffering be suffering. Like, just let it be what it is, and let that move me to tears, let that move me to sobbing, let that move me to wailing, you know, to crying out to God, whatever that looks like. You know, I think the first step is don't deny the suffering, don't discount it, don't be ashamed of it. Whatever feelings come up for you as a result of suffering are valid. So accept them as valid, let them be what they are, and then let them go when the time comes for you to say, this is horrible. Whatever this is, this was deeply impactful for me. And now, Lord, show me what you want to say to me through this. And then you are able to let him speak to you, to show you where he is, to let him reveal the silver lining of fellowshipping with him in suffering to you. But I think the first step is just let grief be grief. And don't fight it. You know, I feel like the more you fight it, the more you resist something, the more power you give it. And so to let it, just let yourself fall apart a little bit, not in a way that's dangerous, but let yourself be grieved and then let the Lord minister to you there. And then know that he's going to use it for sure. This is not punishment. This is preparation. This is him giving you a story to tell other people of his faithfulness, of his goodness.
We hope you've enjoyed episode 205 of Grit and Grace, the podcast.
Listeners, we are incredibly grateful that you join us each and every week.
And we are so grateful to Salem Books for their sponsorship of this week's episode.
Check out the webpage at gritandgracethepodcast.com/episode205. There you'll find this week's transcript, a link to order Sky Full of Stars, Learning to Surrender to God's Perfect Plans, and a link to Meg's website where you can read more about her journey.
Join us next week when we'll be processing what we've learned from our conversation with Meg.
For today, grow your grit.
Embrace God's grace.
And as God reveals the next step to live your one life well,
we'll be cheering you on. So take it.